how many, so, I mean, I know there's that amazing statistic.
Yes.
There was second in rank.
Yes, we had so many servants at this time. I mean, you think that this is an industrializing country in the 19th century, and the Great Exhibition is showing off this huge achievement of Victorian industry and technology. But we have to go back to that classic statement made by Marx. Here in the land of machinery, we see the most appalling waste of human labor that you could ever imagine. And there, think of the Victorian servant, that at least 1/20th of the laboring population was to be found in the sort of category of servants in across the country. 1/10th to 1/15th of occupations in London and Bath, a spa town like Bath, were servants. Roughly a third of women who held some kind of occupation in the middle of the 19th century would have been servants. It's an extraordinary number. It's 750,000 in the 750,000 in 1850. By 1881, we're talking about 1,400,000 people, most of them women.
What were they doing, though?
What were they doing? They were cleaning the coal scuttles. Look at these coal fires the English went in for. This is not the way that people heated their houses in other parts of the continent, or certainly in America. All that coal and cleaning up all the coal dust, etc., hauling water up and down, cooking often on an open fire. The Carlyles, I mean, if you look at the Carlyles in their modest middle-class house in unfashionable Cheney Walk in Chelsea, as it was in the 1830s, the poor kitchen maid did all the cooking down in the basement on an open fire. And then there was all this domestic labor that you can imagine went into a room like this. Now, the women in the household who were not servants, the female head of household, which she might well have been, or the wife, the older daughters, they weren't idle. We do have them organizing the household, there's the enormous numbers of domestic tasks that would have to be done to keep a house, a middle-class household like this, going. And certainly as these houses got larger and middle-class families got much larger, they had more children in the mid-19th century, managing all that became quite a major task. In this period, it was still the case that a lot of women from the small trades, the small industrial classes, the small professional classes, they were actually working in a family enterprise as well. They were either doing the accounts, running some of the commercial side of the business. They would frequently be working in the shop, or actually, you know, certainly taking part in the business as well. So, and that is something that then disappears in the middle classes, becomes just something that middle class wives did not do in during from the middle of the century onward, but up into the 1830s, and certainly it's still very widespread.
And is it much to do with kind of advertising your social status as anything else? I mean, as you were saying before, if you were middle class.
Yes.
Presumably, how you have at least one servant. Was that one of the markers that separated you from the lower classes?
Yes, sir. It was. It didn't mean that you could still be middle class and not necessarily have a live-in servant. There were a lot of people who did occasional charring, and it was possible to hire someone who did occasional charring for as little as sort of £3 a year, as it were. And if you had a sort of fairly small income as a as small as a curate or a very a tradesman on his way up into aspiring, as when he was young and aspiring to move into the middle classes. They would be more likely to have someone who came in and as they moved into a bigger house to acquire a live-in servant.
Right. But, yeah. You know, we look yes. back from now, in the 20th, yeah. I mean, very few, even the rich, have servants. Mm. I mean, yeah. You know what I mean? So the fact that it was a norm back then is quite
absolutely
strange.
I mean, it was just sort of maintaining these large households, and they were all run in very strict, disciplined order. It was the only way to keep it all together, because there was sort of maybe there could have been four or five children, and you would by that time be in a household where there would probably be about three live-in servants. And to keep all of that and the whole household running sort of very smoothly, they were run on very, very strict lines. And it was just very much considered the norm to be able to keep that. And these servants, the householder took responsibility for those servants that he or she hired, and for providing a reference for them for going on to another job. So they're very much part of the household, but kept off in a separate part of the household, as it were, because there had to be a separate suite or a separate area of rooms for them.
I read that they had to be almost invisible, didn't they? They were up before the people
yes,
arrived down to the
yes.
breakfast, and everything had to be clean while they
yes,
were down.
Yes, that's right. But on the other hand, you have to think that your lives were never entirely private, as long as there were servants around. The walls had ears, and so this was actually carrying on. It was a sort of, it certainly was the case among the wealthier households in the 18th century, that it was just extending this practice much more widely to the middling classes in the 19th century.
Just to go back to the idea of these goods coming in, and, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, the Victorians mm-hmm. or people in the 1830s are buying more and more, and all these shops are selling them more and more. What do they actually do with all the goods? I'm just trying to get around to the idea that you didn't necessarily use them all, but you
yes,
displayed
yes,
them. Somehow
okay,
that
yes,
sort of represented
yes,
something.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's almost like your social status was in the way you displayed your goods.
Yes. Now, I think that it was very important to people, to the early Victorians, to be seen to be living this gentle, this middle class lifestyle, and you said who you were by the sociability you had, but also by how you displayed your goods and your house, and having the correct kind of furniture laid out in the correct middle class way. Having curtains at your windows and displaying the modern, again, it's sort of also displaying one's modernity, sort of modern attitudes. Having a modern set of earthenware or porcelain, less expensive porcelain. On display. This was really important, displaying your commodities. And so we get the houses have much more in them than we have found in the early 18th century. Now, some of that was, as I've said, is about comfort and convenience, and but it was also about decoration and display. Even back in the 18th century, people did like to cover their walls with pictures, but this continues in the 19th century. So there's a real kind of market for art amongst fairly ordinary people, that even if you couldn't afford a painting, you could afford a print. And that was, I mean, that print culture of the 18th century is really important. And so that is displayed. And the kinds of pictures that you display too, also we have family scenes, family settings here, and various portraits. but also a display of the modern new commodities to show that you were really up with the times and you had, you know, you had made it.
Right, and you were telling me about the comparative price pictures and frames.
Yes. Oh, well.
The fact that you'd spend more on it.
Yes, that's right. What was really expensive in the, certainly the 18th century, I think it was this, it was starting to change by the early 19th century, but it was the frames that were really expensive. That's where a lot of crafts, a great deal of craftsmanship went into. Frames were, they were one of them, a major luxury import in the 18th century. They're in the customs accounts in proliferation. Frames for mirrors and for pictures. Quite often a framed mirror was worth far more than a picture now that we would be valuing way beyond all other things, but the mirror, especially its frame, much, much more expensive. So that is the processes are created, are found in the course of the early 19th century of creating cheaper framing and also using paper mache for all kinds of decorative effects that would have previously relied on plaster work or on wood carving. And so there is another innovation that's brought in that makes a lot of this cheaper.
Tell me again about imitation and how it's not necessarily what we think of imitation today. Today we think of imitation as being not as good as the thing we're imitating. But back in the, whatever it is, the turn of the century, the early 19th century, it wasn't
seen
like that, was it?
No, it's... The really striking thing about these consumer goods that we're seeing is that they were available in much greater proliferation, but the other thing was that they were much sought after. They were really desired because they were modern novelties. And these imitation goods, they were made with new materials, they were made with a whole kind of series of new techniques, stamping, printing, all sorts of dyes and new chemical processes, all these being applied in order to make this. And there were just departures made in decoration and design. So that the end, and actually what you created out of them. So whole new types of objects were created. And so this is what the imitation actually resulted in, something that was much, much more desirable, not something that was a cheap copy.
Well, give me an example of an imitation being valued as much as the original.
Sorry.
The carpet, even. I mean, the story.
Yes.
About
yes. Okay. If you want to.
Yeah. The Turkish carpet.
The we all know that Turkish carpets were highly, certainly highly valued in the 17th, the 18th century. They're often displayed in portraits and family groups at the time. But when Thomas Whitty invented this process of making sort of Axminster carpets as a woven carpet, it was in a sense an imitation of a Turkish carpet, but it was something that was completely, it looked completely different. It was a completely new thing. It was also better because it was a deep pile. It was much more comfortable and warm in these houses, and so the rich wanted it as well as the middling classes. It wasn't something that he was fobbing off the middling classes with because they couldn't afford a Turkish carpet. This was also the case with some of Wedgwood's finest earthenware. He could easily say it. He could sell it to people who could easily afford the finest Chinese porcelain, but they wanted Wedgwood because it was the latest. The design was just so up to the minute, And in fact, he anticipated all the design trends. That was what his marketing was all about, to go out there and actually anticipate changes in fashion. And so it was fashion that went with it as much as anything else. Imitation allowed a fashion expression. And so we see that being carried across from Axminster carpets, earthenware, through to silver-plated candlesticks.
Excellent. Very good answer. Okay. Okay, let's come in a minute.
That's good. Yeah, we're running.
Okay.
So were there people telling the new middle classes how to use these consumer goods and how to display them?
Yeah. Well, a tradition had arisen really from Wedgwood in the 18th century of retailing new commodities, new consumer goods in an entirely new way. What Wedgwood and Matthew Boulton did this too, what they did was they set up galleries which didn't display their chinaware, their earthenware, or their ornamental metalware on a series of shelves and just, you know, that you go in and pick something off. They set up room displays on what it ought to look like. And they actually consulted arbiters of taste on the new things that they developed. Matthew Boulton consulted with Mrs. Montague, the queen of the blues in the 18th century, the great leader of the blue stocking circle. And she was virtually an aristocrat. Her husband ran these, well, she took part in it too, running a great complex of mines in the north, but ran a salon in a great house in London. And she would give them, it was people like her who said what was the latest in taste, and they would go away and develop these things, and then took on this retailing principle of displaying these room settings in what was like almost like a gallery. People would come to these shops as if they were visiting an art gallery. And this whole way of selling goods was continued into the 19th century. And it was at this time we had also the development of manuals and catalogs. We had the trade catalogs being used extensively in the 18th century. So people could come in, or tradespeople who were selling to the middling orders at that time and to wealthier people, could see designs that would be available. They were almost like design catalogs. But now in the 19th century, a new print, a much more extensive print culture is available. And by this time we have cookery books, etc., and sort of manuals of household management being produced, and even manuals of household furnishings. And the famous one of the late 1830s was Luden's encyclopedia. Of his encyclopedia of furnishings, and he would say what included designs, etc., the latest in furnishings would be, and what you would be expected to put into a drawing room, a dining room, how you would decorate it, what kind of curtains you would use. And if this wasn't enough for you, you could also visit some of the fashionable London furnishers such as Gillows or Seddon's, and these two put together upholstery and furnishings and displayed what was the latest in good taste in what you would put into a middling class home. And so we see, you know, some of these furnishings here and sort of new developments in light furnishings.
And was good taste one of the prerequisites for belonging to the middle class? Did you have to have good taste? Was that something you had to have?
Well, something you aspired to. I don't think that Ruskin and Morris thought that the mid-Victorian middle classes displayed very much good taste. If you were to get a sense of this going around the Great Exhibition, but This was something that one aspired to. It was very important in the late 18th century. That was where the whole concept of luxury had moved on to, was living a civilized lifestyle, and a civilized lifestyle with aesthetics and taste. And that is something that was certainly aspired to. By the 1830s, we have a much broader middling class, and that sense of what was good taste, it's something that was not so much in the forefront of debate and discussion. It's taken up again in the later period when we move on to Ruskin and Morris.
What is it? Just to go back to first principle, what is a luxury? What are luxury goods? What is luxury in that sense?
What is luxury?
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Was this period the first time we're starting to see luxury? I mean, in that sort of scale, this widespread, use of goods. Is it because they don't have a function? Is that a luxury good that doesn't have a function? I don't even know.
Yes, well, there is a long debate that goes on about what is luxury and how can it be defined? It was a question that was raised at the very beginning of the 18th century by Bernard Mandeville, who was confronting all these people who were trying to argue that luxury was a corrupting force, and that we should really be living in a much more austere lifestyle. And he condemned them as hypocrites. Said, how do you define luxury? Is cleanliness luxury? I mean, just look at the few people who have the ability to stay clean. Is having clean air or clean water, is that a luxury? Well, at the beginning of the 18th century, it certainly was a luxury. It is very much a relative concept, and it's just very much the context in which it's discussed. But as I said, the meaning of the term changes, whether it's a bad or a good thing, a good quality, something to aspire after, that changes over the course of the 18th century. And what we are finding in the later 18th century is a great deal of discussion about civility, about manners, politeness, taste, aesthetics, and that's what people meant by luxury then, and it was something that was to be aspired to. But moving into the early 19th century, we see a great deal more proliferation of many more consumer goods. That sense of, I think there is a sort of sense in which this, as the focus on the civility, on the taste and aesthetics was starting to lose its focus, and a profusion. Again, what we're seeing here is an attempt to display a profusion of objects, not choosing. Well, there is a sense in which the objects are chosen because they're modern, etc. But a profusion of these objects, not a selection. Probably earlier, because that's all one could have. I mean, a few very precious things that were saved for and aspired to. And people did save to have these correct things in their houses. It was very important, and these were passed down to younger generations later. And that was but it is a much greater profusion.
And you see a lot, just going next door, you see those kind of look like kind of useless bits of crystalware.
They don't
seem to have a function.
No.
And you get the idea that you have the coming of the whatnot. That doesn't have any other function on display things. Maybe you can tell me a bit about the actual displaying of these objects and the objects themselves. That's what I was kind of meaning by luxury.
Yes.
They don't really,
they don't have, yes, they are just ornamental, but so much in this room is just ornamental too. The pictures on the walls, many of the objects that might have something of a functional aspect to them are also ornamental ware. If we look at those lusters, they're very much in the same kind of pattern, the same kind of sense as Wedgwood's ornamental vases, which were displayed sometimes on the most frightful wall sconces all over. And these ornamental vases were usually very small, stuck on these sconces in aristocratic houses on large walls. They are very much the 18th century version of the Victorian whatnot. And so I don't really think that that is an entirely new development. It's just more of a greater profusion of ornament that was called ornamental ware in the 18th century. They're just ornaments